Just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. Say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes.
Hello folks, my name is Henry Rollins. It is time to donate to KUCI. Please do it. You can call them at 949-824-KUCI. That's 949-824-5824. Or you can donate easily online by going to kuci.org. Please do it. Thanks.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
Good morning and welcome to this April 24th, 2013 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. More information on that later in this hour. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone, and as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each week, Barbara DeMarco Barrett is here with authors, poets, agents, giving you the latest and most up-to-date information on the publishing world. As you may have heard, this is Fund Drive Week here at KUCI. We come to you just a couple of times a year, asking for you, our listeners, to help us out. This is the only way we stay on the air. We've been here since 1968, bringing you continuous, nonstop, 24/7 radio, and the only way we can do that is from listener support. You guys have always been incredibly generous, and we're looking for your calls today, 949-824-5824. We've got premiums, prizes, gift certificates to bookstores, all for your modest donations. We're just asking for what you can give, and we appreciate your help. It's my honor to be joined by Anna Quinlan talking about her memoir this morning, The Gifts of Growing Older. The book is Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake. Anna Quinlan is a novelist and journalist whose work has appeared on fiction, nonfiction, and self-help bestseller lists. Her book, A Short Guide to a Happy Life, has had sold more than a million copies. While a columnist at the New York Times, she won the Pulitzer Prize and published two collections, Living Out Loud and Thinking Out Loud. Her Newsweek columns were collected in Loud and Clear, She is the author of 6 novels, including One True Thing and Every Last One. And her latest memoir, Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake, is what we'll be talking about this morning. It's my pleasure to welcome her. Anna, hi.
Good morning.
Good morning. So tell me what inspired the memoir, why you felt it was important for you to write it.
There were 2 moments, I think, that started this book. The first is described within the book, a moment when a tornado hit our house in Pennsylvania, and my daughter called me sobbing and said she was afraid of history repeating itself, by which she meant that she knew that my mother had died when I was quite young, and she didn't want anything bad to happen to me. And without even thinking about it, I replied, "Oh, honey, I'm too old to die young now." And at the moment I said that, I thought, this means something. I understand suddenly that I've passed over into another stage of my life. And the other moment that really set this up was when I was writing my last column for Newsweek about the need for people who had been in positions for a long time to step aside and make room for younger people, younger voices in my case. And in doing the research, I discovered that in the year I was born, 1952, the average life expectancy of an American was 68 years old, which I found astonishing. Mm-hmm. And given the fact that now it's more like 80, I realized that we'd gained an entire 12 years during the 60s and 70s that just feel substantively different than they did for generations before us, and that in a highly personal way, I wanted to explore that.
And you mentioned in the book, yeah, it's impacted marriage because, you know, when you partner with somebody 50 years ago, you were partnering with them for, you know, maybe 20 years or 30 years as opposed to, you know, 68 years or something. All of the ways that this ripples through, and where those extra years are added, they're not necessarily added right at the end. They, you know, maybe they're added to the teenage years, and this is why our kids aren't leaving home.
Well, they're no different at the end than they've always been. I mean, getting much older, approaching the end of life, it is somewhat the same as it's always been, although healthcare makes it sometimes more bearable. But I think when I look at my grandparents, for example, in their 50s and 60s, they were satisfied to think of themselves as elderly people at some level. And most of the people I know in their 60s are not so satisfied. In fact, their backs go up when you suggest it. So I think we are facing a new period of life which we failed to name. And believe me, I tried. I spent 2 years thinking at some moment I'm going to coin a clever phrase that will pass into the lexicon to describe this period of life. Never even got close. But I do just think in terms of how much longer we're working, in terms of, as you said, how much longer we're married, in terms of the fact that, like most people, I have some responsibility for my aging father and still more responsibility than my parents had for my adult children, the landscape has changed in ways that are really, really interesting.
And all of these requirements to reinvent yourself.
Yeah, well, I actually find that incredibly exciting, but anybody who's followed my career at all knows that. As I sometimes say, I've quit more good jobs than most people have had. You know, I do really feel if there's something that you've always wanted to do, first of all, you have more time to do it in, but second of all, given the peripatetic nature of mortality, you probably should do it now. And I've tried to follow that directive as much as mortgage payments make feasible.
Right. Right. So, we probably haven't adequately introduced the memoir itself. Tell our listeners a little bit about choosing the subject matter of the essays and, kind of the scope and breadth of the memoir.
It seemed to me that there were just obvious things that I had to deal with in the book. I certainly knew I had to deal with the issue of mortality, because when people get so agitated about aging, they usually state it in terms of, you know, they can't play as much tennis as they once did, or there's odd lines appearing on their face or on their hands. But what they're really saying under the radar is, I'm closer to the end of my life than I am to the beginning of it, and that's terrifying for people. So I knew I had to deal with mortality. Certainly from my point of view, I knew I had to deal with long marriage and with motherhood. And then there were other things that just occurred to me as I went along. There's a chapter in there that was a little bit of self-discovery and that I think is really important about how cruel, unthinkingly cruel at some level, the women who rode the crest of second wave feminism were to the women who went before them. Mm-hmm. The idea that we just discounted our mothers and our grandmothers and the things they'd done. I was ready to say the choices they made, but of course the whole point was that they didn't have the choices that we had. And yet we were still a little dismissive of them. We acted a little bit as though we invented the wheel. You know, I think I quote one woman as saying to me, "Oh, girls, get over yourselves." You know, all this stuff about natural childbirth and you know, open communication with your children. There was this covert sense that they'd done everything wrong and we were going to do everything right. And of course, that's typical of generations, and I encounter it all the time now with young women on college campuses. But I think for those of us who were the heiresses to the women's movement, it was tinged with this sense of choice and privilege that made us for several decades a little unpleasant to our elders. And I wrote a chapter that's a kind of a sustained mea culpa for that.
Right. My guest this morning is Anna Quinlan. The book is Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake. Talk about growing older as a writer, your evolution over time as a writer, and, you know, what you would might tell your younger writer self now with sort of this, you know, body of experience.
Well, that's very interesting because I'm struck by the fact that no less a writer than Philip Roth has just announced that he's not going to write anymore, that writing is frustrating and humiliating, and I couldn't agree with him more about that. I will say that the advantage that I've gained as I've grown older, other than the fact that I just understand everything better, and if I didn't, what would that say, is that as a woman, I think it's particularly notable. About 10 years ago, I suddenly realized that I didn't really care what anybody thought anymore. And for a woman who spent her entire life getting societal messages about how I ought to look and how I ought to live and how I ought to be, to just be able to say, "Oh, shut up," was hugely liberating. And I think it was really helpful as a writer that I still felt and will always feel, and I think we all always feel, that kind of Jiminy Cricket on your shoulder of judgment saying, "Well, that sentence isn't very felicitous, and this isn't very interesting, and do you really think readers will like that?" But I'm better able to put that Jiminy Cricket in his place at this point. And I think that's a huge boon, because so much of being a writer is about anticipating judgment. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no feeling in the world like sitting at a table in a bookstore with a stack of your books in front of you and having someone walk up, pick up a book, read the flap copy, put it down, and walk away. I mean, it couldn't be clearer. You have been found wanting. And to not care so much about being found wanting, to make the deal with yourself that this is good work and that you're happy to put it out there is hugely liberating, and at least for me has come with age.
And interesting that you should say that, because it strikes me that you know, a lot of novelists talk about not having an awareness of the audience and certainly not writing to an audience. But a book like this felt, you know, sort of, I mean, very personal, sort of advice giving, sort of, you know, what I've learned from the trenches, where it felt like you did have some sort of audience in mind, either an audience of your peers or an audience of younger women coming up through the generations. And so to maintain both that more personal connection with the reader, I might say, and at the same time not tremendously caring what the reader thinks of you personally, I think is a really elegant line to walk.
Well, the issue of audience is really interesting because you get asked about it all the time. I think I learned early on as a columnist at the New York Times that it was doomed to failure to try to write to a specific audience because I really had no clue who the audience was. I mean, I would write a one of my Life in the 30s columns and think that, you know, maybe some young mothers were reading it. And then I'd get a great letter from some 85-year-old retired school teacher who'd tell me why it had so much resonance for her. And I realized that if I tried in any way, shape, or form to write to an audience, I was going to miss a lot of my potential readers. So I really think that the audience that I write for is myself. And I've learned to trust that that means that the net is wider than just one person. Having said that, with this book, to some extent, it was a response to a specific group of women. And those were women who had read the Life in the 30s columns when I was in my 30s, when they were in their 30s at home raising young children, and who over the years since had said, oh, I wish you'd write Life in the 40s or Life in the 50s. And to some extent, it was a catch-up with them. But I hope that I was able to cast a broader net with the memoir and therefore pull in some people who, in fact, weren't even familiar with that column.
Right, right. My guest this morning is Anna Quinlan, the book Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake. You're kind of tangentially raising, I think, another interesting issue, which is how well you're a writer for a very specific generation and a writer for sort of universal human experience, and how you've taken the specific generation that you're in and sort of broadly written about it to span generations. And I'm wondering about your awareness of that and whether you can sort of speak to how you accomplished it.
Well, I think that I'm always aware of it because I'll do a bookstore event and there'll be a real critical mass there of women who will say, I've been following you since you were first at the New York Times, or I've been following you since your first novel, Object Lessons. And you realize that there's this kind of core group of people who are like you. Random House did some market research not long ago on who reads my work, and I think the term they came up with was mature literati. it was sort of a caricature, an artist caricature of a woman walking away from an empty baby stroller dressed in what looked like Eileen Fisher clothes. And I said to them, okay, so what you're telling me is I'm writing for myself. But what you do hope is that that there'll be a trickle-down effect of that. And one of the things that's been really, really great about the response to this book is how many women in their 20s have said to me, boy, this was so interesting to me because it showed me where I'm heading.
Uh-huh.
And that was really gratifying because you don't want to just be writing for one audience. And to know that you were picking up younger women who felt that you had something to say to them as well was really terrific.
Yeah. You've talked about how motherhood made you a better writer, that you could re-experience the world through the eyes of your and perceptions of your children, which, you know, in turn, your characters. And I'm wondering if you could talk about that a little, of reimagining the world through the eyes of another, what sort of motherhood brought to bear on writing?
I must say, that's something that I really didn't see coming, but of course, most of the glories of being the mother of my three kids, I didn't see coming. But specifically, the fact that, you know, the sharp edges of experience get worn off the older we become. And to watch a four-year-old encounter thunder or the ocean or ice cream for the first time. All of those sharp edges of sensation come back to you, and you see everything more technicolor than you did before because they do. And I just think it really made a great difference in my writing to be able to see that. And today, one of the things that I find really helps my writing is all three of my kids are writers in different incarnations. And working with them, for example, Christopher just finished his most recent young adult novel. He's writing a series for HarperCollins. And I did edits on his Bound Galleys, you know, typos and the like. And we sat down together and went over them. And it made me re-experience my own work in a really positive way, in a way that sometimes I don't do when I'm doing it in a vacuum for myself.
Interesting. And did writing in turn make you a better or a different parent, do you think?
Oh, that's a good question. I think the kids would say that when I was still doing particularly a twice weekly column, they say that I had something that they would call my welfare reform face, which would mean that I was present, but I was really thinking of big policy issues at a moment when I should have been thinking about dinner table conversation. So I think to some extent it was a mixed bag. I think I was frequently distracted in a way that is not always optimal. But, you know, bottom line is I did my best, and bottom line is they can't feel too hostile to the writing process since they all have embraced it themselves.
Right.
As my husband says, not a W-2 income in the house.
And flatter or imitation being the, whatever, greatest form of flattery, right?
Actually, I think for kids who are the kids of writers, it's more simple and interesting than that. I mean, people will always say to me, they got the writer's DNA. And I always respond, if that were true, then Dickens would have spawned 9 fantastic writers as opposed to the slightly ne'er-do-well and mixed bag of kids he did. I just think when you grow up in a household where somebody's writing all the time, it's demystified. You realize that, you know, the muse does not arrive, that it's mainly a matter of powering up with enough caffeine and putting your butt on the seat of a chair in front of a computer and getting it done. And I think they see it as workmanlike in the way that if I had been a stonemason, they would see building drywall.
Mm-hmm. Right. My guest this morning is Anna Quinlan, the book Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake. I think this sort of about-face change of heart you had on motherhood is a really interesting one. In your 20s, you had pretty affirmatively, you said, decided against children and went on to have 3 amazing children. And I'm wondering that sort of change of heart being a very effective personality dynamic for a writer to be able to see the world, you know, really one way and then switch perspectives and see it really another. And I'm wondering if that has informed other parts of your life or if this is sort of a theme of life of seeing the world one way and shifting and seeing it a different way and how that's translated to your writing.
Well, that is the kindest possible construct on my change of heart about having children, which I thought of at the time and still sort of think of in retrospect as being completely addled and random. The reason why I didn't want to have kids is pretty simple and easy to figure out. I was 19 and the oldest of 5 when our mother died, and I wound up having a fair amount of responsibility for my younger siblings, especially my sister, who was only 8 at the time. I sort of thought of that as the mothering experience, not as being a faux mother under the worst possible circumstances. And the end result is that throughout my 20s, I thought, not for me. Don't want to do this. So I was extremely ambitious, and I thought it would get in the way of my work, which to some extent can be true. And I cannot for the life of me still figure out why suddenly at age 30, as though a flip had been switched, I changed my mind. I am so unbelievably grateful that I did, because I really feel like being a mother has been the making of me as a human being. And I would like to think that I'm capable of multiple and sharp-edged perspectives, mainly because of my life as a reporter, frankly. I think if you're a good reporter, you're always looking for the different voices that inform a story, the different points of view that inform an issue. I think when I became an opinion columnist, it was a little challenging for me to write a column that didn't just boil down to, on the one hand, on the other hand, because I was so accustomed to plumbing that that mechanism to get at some version of the truth. But I'm not sure if any of that came to bear on what turned out to be the most important decision of my life, the decision to have those kids. I still, in retrospect, am not exactly sure where that all came from. But I think the ability to see the world from various perspectives is definitely an offshoot of my lifelong work as a reporter.
Yeah. Well, has there been a point in time when you have felt like you can finally relax as a writer, not in terms of content, but just in terms of, you know, now you have a body of work beneath you, you have the confidence that you have the skill level and the talent, where you can sort of relax and breathe and trust the process rather than being the, you know, hyper-anxious writer that so many are?
I'm still pretty anxious, but I have to say I've gotten more comfortable in my novelist skin as time has gone on. And actually, I've just finished a novel that will be published in February 2014 that is about as relaxed as I've ever been as a writer. I felt like I was trying something completely different than I'd tried before in terms of tone, in terms of perspective, it does feel like a really relaxed book to me, which belies how hard I worked on it. And I felt a real sense of accomplishment with that. The executive editor at Random House said to me, "This is the most Anna novel you've ever written." And I think that's what she was noting, and it made me very happy.
I love that. We're drawing down on our time, but I'm curious about your thoughts on publishing, having written for newspapers, written novels. Of course, newspapers have had their troubles, and I'm curious about your sort of predictions for the future. If writers are going to have to become much stronger marketers, where this sort of self-publishing business is going, you know, where sort of you feel like the center of gravity is shifting to in the business.
I think anybody who predicts the future on this is really playing a fool's game, because everything has changed so quickly over the last 20 years. Having said that, I think there was a level of agitation and craziness about digital, about self-publishing, about online sales, about online journalism 3 or 4 years ago that seems to have leveled off somewhat. I mean, the New York Times still produces, physically, the best newspaper on paper in the country. It also produces online the best newspaper website in the country. So we now know that we can walk and chew gum at the same time, and that some readers like to walk and some readers like to chew gum. Similarly, in digital sales, what we're starting to find in the publishing business is that the digital marketplace has plateaued out, that there is a substantial percentage of the readership that really likes to read digitally, but there's still a big chunk that really like to read on paper. And that's what I find as a writer. I mean, I would say my market at this point is about 50-50, which I would not have predicted, say, 5 or 6 years ago, but which works just fine. And while clearly there are opportunities for self-publishing that there never were before, I really take offense at the conventional wisdom that publishing houses are simply clunky, dated interlocutors. I don't know about anybody else, but my work benefits enormously from the work that's done at Random House, first in the editing, then in the copy editing, then in the production, then in the marketing.